Coming up, we got John Fanta previewing the Eastern Conference semifinals playoffs and also talking about what was an unbelievable Eastern Conference playoff first round. That's all coming up right now with me and John Fanta. What a first round. Joining me to discuss the Eastern Conference side of things, it's John Fanta from NBC Sports. John, what's up?
Kevin, are you kidding me? It is the wild, wild East. It is nonstop theater. I'm doing great, my friend. It's good to see you. And wow, what a roller coaster ride it's already been, my friend.
Oh, my God. We had three game sevens, 2-3-1 comebacks. We'll start on Saturday night in Boston because I was there for the Sixers completing their 3-1 comeback against the Celtics. Joel Embiid changed absolutely everything in this series. For a guy who has had a playoff reputation as a playoff disappointment, whether it's been due to inefficiencies or an inability to stay on the floor, Embiid won this series for the Sixers. And it felt like in games 5, 6, and 7, Mazzulla increasingly saw there's no answers for Embiid, because in game 5, he got Kata into quick foul trouble, and then they had Vooch on Embiid, and they buried him over and over and over, scored on him 4 times in the third. Then in game 6, Embiid had 8 assists. They started using Garza on him. He dominated him. And then in game 7, I think Mazzulla realized, my bigs, they can't do anything against this guy. Yeah. He starts off with Garza, and Garza's getting dominated and puts on Jaylen Brown and Hugo Gonzalez. They're sending doubles his way, and nothing worked at all. He's just too big. 29-9-7 in the series. Hits a clutch three-pointer at the end of game 4 as well. Midway through the fourth, Celtics cut it to 1. John, the crowd was so blaring loud, and Embiid hit the three-pointer. Quiet everything down, settle the Sixers down. He hit some clutch free throws as well. And that's like just the offense. The defense, he was unbelievable as well. Changed everything for Boston. They were 13 points per 100 possessions better defensively with Embiid out there. Can't say enough about what Joel Embiid did in this series, John. He looked like the MVP version of himself.
And you just think what a difference a year makes for the Philadelphia 76ers, Kevin. And it's why there was so much frustration last year and so much disappointment, because it's not as if Nick Nurse can't coach. It's not as if Philadelphia doesn't have the talent to make a run to an Eastern Conference title. I mean, this team can win the East. You know, they really can, because the talent's always been there. It's a matter of health. And when Joel Embiid plays like this, he's a top 5 most valuable player in the NBA. Like that's how valuable I think he is. He creates so much for Philadelphia. And let's stick to the defensive end of the floor, because if you don't have Joel Embiid out there, Boston's going to be able to get to the rim. They're going to be able to have their drive and kick there. And look, I thought Boston, there's a reliance on the three. There's an over-reliance on the three. And then there's what they did this series. And Scott Van Pelt wrote this on Saturday night. He said, in the 4 losses, I've got Boston 49 for 179 from three. I mean, that is damning stuff. That's there's a philosophy, but then this is a bit extreme. But the reason why Boston had to fall into that on Saturday is because they couldn't get to the rim, because Joel Embiid was everywhere. So I think that this is the most interesting storyline in the playoffs right now, is that the Sixers look the part of a team that can make a very deep run, that could be playing into June. Yeah. And I know who they've got next. And I know that this is the Eastern Conference Finals for me. This next series, the Sixers and the Knicks, the winner of this series, I believe, will win the East. But Philadelphia, man, you know, they are not a 7 seed. They're the furthest thing from that. And it's why back in October, I went on a rant, and I'm just like, Philly, get off the frickin' mat. You have what it takes to make something happen this season. And now they have.
It happened at the perfect time. I mean, it's amazing how things can just shift. They're down 3-1 and beat in game 4. Didn't look like himself. It turned out it was just a warm-up game for him, because he looked like his MVP self ever since then for Philadelphia. And I mean, look, I'm beyond happy for Embiid. I've been an Embiid fan since pre-draft. Like, I was rooting for that guy when he missed his first 2 years. I remember one of the first long Ringer articles I wrote early in my career was about Joel Embiid. Like, hey, don't forget about this guy. He has a chance to be a truly special player. I've loved him for a decade now. So I'm very happy for him, despite, you know, everything he's gone through and all the challenges. But like he said after the game, the reason why the Sixers are on this point is because it's, you can't win alone. Those were his words. You can't win alone. And you look at what Maxey did in this game. Tyrese Maxey, 30 points, 11 boards, 7 assists, some really good defense as well. And the end of that game, when Embiid kind of got hit by Maxey himself after Jaylen Brown got the push off, trying to draw a foul, flopper over there, Jaylen Brown. We'll talk about him in a minute. Embiid got hit in the knee, and he's kind of lumbering around a little bit, but Maxey, the two layups he hit, like, I was in the arena, and to me, it looked like Allen Iverson out there going to the basket with those clutch, acrobatic layups. Those were unbelievable plays that he had down the stretch of that game to help win it for Philadelphia, because Boston was coming. Like, look at these replays if you're watching on YouTube. Look how fast he is. Couldn't stay in front of him. I mean, it's unbelievable.
It is unbelievable. He is the franchise. He is this franchise's piece. I mean, he makes them go. And Embiid benefits as a result. You know who else has benefited? VJ Edgecombe.
Yes. Got him going with the assist early in the game.
Yeah, and this might come off as a hot take, but to me, Edgecombe's production and his shot making, and he made 5 threes in this win. He had 23 points. I'm not just saying because of this isolated game, Kevin, but I think he is as if not more important than Paul George at this stage. Because Paul George, I'm not trying to diminish him, and he played 42 minutes in this game. He had 13 points, and you know, he's shown some signs. But when Edgecombe and Maxey are both in live wire mode, like, they're both hitting threes, they're playing a two-man game in the backcourt, like, let me drive to the elbow, take on a couple of defenders potentially, they collapse, I can get into VJ, and VJ's cashing in on threes. It's electric. Like, this is a Sixers formula that can work. They only play 6 guys. Like, Quentin Grimes comes in off the bench. I mean, a couple other guys appeared. Drummond played 8 minutes, but Grimes is a 6th man, and they're just rocking with everybody else, the 5 that they've got beyond besides him. So for me, this is sustainable. Like, this isn't a fluke. You don't come back from 3-1 down and it's a fluke. You have to beat a team 3 consecutive times. And you just beat Boston. I mean, Boston, I thought Boston would represent the Eastern Conference in the NBA Finals. Now, I didn't have Jason Tatum getting hurt, but that's not an excuse. Boston was at home. They spent the majority of the year without Tatum. They could have won this game. They didn't. They didn't because Maxey and Embiid and Edgecombe refused to lose this game.
They had 3 chances to win the series. They had 3 chances. It's just the reality of it. And they didn't do it. I mean, with VJ Edgecombe, it's kind of poetic in a way, because he opens his career. His rookie debut is on opening night against the Boston Celtics. In Boston, he has 34 points in that game. It's like, oh my God, VJ Edgecombe, this isn't the same guy at Baylor last year. Oh my goodness. And then he ends Boston season in Boston with 23 points and 44 minutes. They were leaving him open at times from 3, and he just made him pay. And then he played extraordinary defense to start the game against Jaylen Brown. Can we show that clip again of him not turning his back as Jaylen Brown drove, because they didn't want him getting back? Well, because they knew he didn't have his left hands, so they just tried to steer him towards the rim.
Brilliant.
Edgecombe in the second half, Nick Nurse said he asked to defend Derek White instead because White had a big first half and he made his life hard. I have never seen a rookie do things at 20 years old in the playoffs than what VJ Edgecombe is doing right now. I've never seen this before at age 20 in the postseason. Makes no sense.
It's also why the NBA is in a great period of time. When people sit here and say, oh, it's not what it used to be, or it's not this, it's not, you're not watching. the crop of young talent right now in the league is as big a storyline as any. Just look at the Rookie of the Year race, which was the second closest contested Rookie of the Year race in the last 24 years. So Cooper Fly beats out Con Knipl, but then look who's here. VJ Edgecombe. And there's a number of other rookie storylines, and if not rookie storylines, sophomore storylines of guys who are in year two in their career, and they've taken off. And they've taken off at a rate that really is special. So I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, just look at a Stephon Castle on San Antonio and the guy that he has become on both ends of the floor. Dylan Harper and what he's done down there. I mean, it's why they can win it all. But like, yeah, you trade Jared McCain, because at the end of the day, Kevin, what you're going to put Jared McCain on the bench and not put VJ Edgecombe out? Or you're going to play Jared McCain and you're not going to put this guy out there? Like, VJ Edgecombe partially gave him the ability to do that. So Philadelphia is dangerous here. And as you look at this series with the Knicks, this is theater. It's Tyrese Maxey versus Jalen Brunson. And we know Maxey's already had his fair share of moments in Madison Square Garden. The two, you could argue that there's not two players who determine their team ceiling more than Joel Embiid with the Sixers and Karl Anthony Towns with the Knicks. And now they square off. Like, that is what we sign up for. I would say that. They're the two players who determine, maybe next to Wemby, they're the two players who determine whether their teams are going to get this thing done or not. And then it's the wing play. Like, the wing play for both Philadelphia and New York is interesting because it can swing them one direction or the other. Are the Knicks going to impose their will defensively? Are they going to say enough is enough with Edgecombe, Kelly Oubre Jr., we're not going to let you get free, and our OG, Mikal Bridges and Josh Hart, going to show? Or are they going to no-show?
I when you started out saying there's not two players in the league who ... I thought you were going to say hate each other more than Joel Embiid and Karl Anthony Towns.
Well, that too.
Because these guys, they got a history, John. They got a real history going at each other on social media, calling each other names, especially Joel towards Kat, and on the court, a lot of talking too. Like, this could be the best series. It probably will be the best series, I think, of the four remaining in the semifinals. Well, and this,
and here's the thing. The Knicks Celtics, the Knicks would have beat the Celtics.
I think, like, so too. The Knicks fixed themselves. They fixed themselves, I think, last round.
Yeah. This is a better series for the NBA. It's a better series for the playoffs, I think. And I mean, look at this. If you're watching the back and forth on social media where Embiid, they've called each other out. This is going to be awesome. Like,
I'm hoping they defend each other, John. I'm hoping they are not. I'm hoping it's not Embiid defended by Josh Hart, double teams. I hope it's not Embiid defending Hart, sagging off him, and it's, you know, Paul George or whoever defending Karl Anthony Towns. I want Embiid versus Cat, possession after possession. And I think that's what the Knicks probably want it to become. Because, like, here's the way I look at it. We don't need to, like, dive super deep into this series, considering the fact that game one is literally tonight. It's a quick turnaround by the time you listen to this podcast. And we're going to do a game one recap tomorrow on my show on Tuesday. But I think, like, Cat offers something so different than what the Celtics could with his size and skill. So I think the Knicks have got to continue playing through him as much as possible, just like they figured out midway through the Hawks series, because you don't want Embiid to be, like, helping off Josh Hart defending near the paint. You want Embiid spaced out on the perimeter against those Karl Anthony Towns elbow actions, top of the key. You want him on the perimeter, wearing him out, creating an open paint, unlike what the Celtics had, where they weren't able to get into their drive and kick. And I think that, to me, if you can force Embiid out, has to be the key. And that would require Karl Anthony Towns being defended by Joel Embiid at some point in the series. But it's going to be tough for Philly because there's nobody like, you know, Kata, not to worry about. You're not worried about Garza if you're the Sixers. But everybody's a concern on the Knicks side of things in this series for Philadelphia. Everybody is.
The coaching matchup's really interesting too, because Mike Brown got questioned in the series with Atlanta with some of the rotations until they figured some things out. You know, the game two loss that they had, there was a lot of like, what's going on here? Why aren't we seeing more of Brunson? Why are we waiting here? So that is how Mike Brown utilizes his different options. You know, whether that's a Jordan Clarkson or a McBride or whoever it might be. And then you just summed it up. If you don't make Joel Embiid uncomfortable when he's on defense, you're doing it wrong. You got to make him guard. You have to get him exhausted. You want him worn out. You know, I don't want this as a basketball fan. You don't want it. But if you're the Knicks, you want him going into game five, game six, where he's like questionable because of the amount that it takes to play in this series. That's how you should be thinking if you're New York. Make it a street fight. Make it what it needs to be. Because if Towns isn't active, the Knicks could be eliminated right now. Towns single-handedly changed the entire series with the Hawks because he got up from his chair and he said, I'm hooping. He changes everything for New York. Like the Knicks, when Josh Hart's defending, when OG Anunoby's making the dirty plays, making things happen. Yeah, it changes who they are and it adds different dimensions. But the difference between Towns being active and Towns being passive or them not getting him the ball, it is a total 180 for this team. But Kevin, I want close game, 4 minutes to go, those two guarding each other and beating Towns. And I really, like, now I'm intrigued to see Brunson and Maxey. Because Brunson
real quick on your note on Embiid though, because the schedule for this series is tough for Philly. That's a factor here. Nick, you said it earlier. Nick Trust plays six guys from game four against Boston on April 26th until game six on Thursday, May 14th. There's only one day of rest between every game. So that's 10 games. Over a couple week period with only one day of rest between. Like, the travel's not that hard between Philly and New York, but still, one day of rest is tough. And so I think for the Knicks, they had 3 days of rest entering game one tonight. The Sixers just played on Saturday, a hard-fought game. Mike Brown's been going nine deep in the series. Nick Nurse is already at six deep. Is he going to have to go a little deeper? Fatigue's going to be a factor, big time in this series for sure. And I think to lead to your point about Maxey and Brunson in this, McCollum versus Brunson in the Hawks-Knicks series. McCollum started out as the guy in the series. It became Brunson. Maxey, I think, is a different level of player than CJ McCollum that the Knicks are going to have to deal with. He is just so fast with the ball in his hands. You're going to have OG Anunoby defending Paul George, Josh Hart, Mikal Bridges. I'd imagine one of them will start on Maxey. My concern with Brunson is, you could hide Brunson last round on Dyson Daniels and say, like, we're not concerned about Daniels shooting. We're not concerned about him dribbling. We're not concerned about him, period, end of story. There's nobody on the Sixers that you can hide Jalen Brunson on. You can't. You can't hide him on even Oubre. Oubre, like, is probably going to be the guy they try to hide him on, bank on him missing threes. But Oubre is more skilled than Atlanta's non-shooters on those attacking closeouts, cuts to the rim. You can't hide him on VJ Edgecombe, that's for sure. So I think there's some matchup problems here for the Knicks in this series.
As long as the Sixers can stay in it and not fatigue.
Yes.
You know, there's the theory, won't go too far into this, of game one, they're coming off the high of Saturday night. Do they show signs of fatigue tonight or on Wednesday? I think it'll be one of the two. But sometimes when you're riding the high, a lot of people are like, well, the Knicks are rested and, you know, 76ers are coming right from Boston to New York. But Kevin, sometimes the team that just has come off that plays better in the first game of the series because they've got momentum, they've got a wave. But you're right. Kelly Oubre Jr. is a huge X factor to this series because in three of his last four games, he's had 6 points or less. And two of those games, it was just a bucket or two. So the fact is, Kelly Oubre has got to step up here, because if they're going to hide Brunson on him, which I do think that they're going to try to do that, there's going to be shots. There's going to be opportunities. And if Kelly Oubre's going and VJ Edgecombe is making shots on top of what Tyrese Maxey's doing, the Knicks are going to have problems defensively. And when the Knicks have to work on defense a lot, Kevin, we've seen it. What happens to their O? It stagnates. The ball gets stuck. Because when they can't get downhill and when they can't get in transition, they're just not the same team at all. So if you're Philadelphia, take care of the ball. Maxey, don't try to do too much, because you've got guys around you who can make it happen too.
Absolutely. I mean, that's true. Maxey, low turnover player as well. So if he can continue that, it does bode well for Philly. I mean, my head says Knicks in seven. My heart says Sixers in six. I'll lean towards the heart with the prediction here. But I think it's going to be an incredible, incredible series. And for Philadelphia, like you said, riding the high of game seven, getting over the hump finally against Boston, in Boston, on the road, getting it done. Then you turn around quick to game one on Monday. And we'll be right back after this break. The Celtics side of that. So I was at the game. Pre-game, we're like some of us are sitting at a table, like in like the dining room before the game, and Abby Chin, who is the Celtics' excellent longtime TV sideline reporter, she's looking at her phone. She says, "Oop, the Celtics' starting lineup is in." And a couple of us are sitting there, and she's like, "Jaylen Brown, Derek White, Baylor Shireman." Someone chimes in, "Oh, so Shireman's getting the start for Tatum." Then she continues, "Ron Harper Jr., Luka Garza." Everybody at the table's jaws drop down to the floor. And we're like, "No way. You're joking. That's a lie." And I pull out my phone and I'm like, "Oh my God, it's true. He's starting Garza, Harper, and Baylor Shireman." And that was the rest of the conversation between media until the game. And it didn't work. They were getting smoked at the start of the game. Just destroyed. They were down 11. Garza out. Harper didn't play the rest of the game. Just a mess. It felt like, to me, Mazzulla got recommended that from a free version of ChatGPT. But that's what it was. Like, yes, you should start those guys. That's what you should do. I couldn't believe it, John. I thought Mazzulla was clearly the coach of the year. I thought he was head and shoulders above everybody else. He was incredible, I thought, during the regular season. But this is now 3 out of 4 years where he has just made baffling after baffling choice in the postseason. With this one, whew, boy, this is the cherry on top of all of them.
Well, I don't know how many times I've ever seen this.
Never. Never.
Three of the five guys who starred in an NBA playoff game did not score.
It's never happened. It's never, literally never happened.
Yeah, I mean, he tried to outsmart himself. He's 37. But it's Boston. I mean, this is a massive disappointment.
37, that's not an excuse. He's coached for 4 years now, and he's won a championship. He's got to be the coach of the year.
We both know, when I say he's 37, we both know this. He's as big a firecracker as there is in the league.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, the guy, you know, and I do respect him. And yeah, he's won a championship, and you're right. Like, it's not an excuse. It's more of an explanation for why the decision was made. You know, he does things that are bold and brash, but when it hurts your team, you have to take accountability, and you have to say, all right, well, this seems to be a reoccurring problem. Where there, Kevin, if you disagree, but this is Boston. There's going to be real pressure on this guy heading into next playoff, provided that they're pretty healthy, and they have to address the front court too. I mean, he can't be blamed for all that. They went and got Nikola Vucevic. Safe to say that didn't work out at all. You know, Simons was playable and whatnot. I mean, this is Vucevic with a DNP. How'd that trade work out? You went and got him to try to bolster your front court, and it totally flopped, Timofey Mozgov style. You know, like it just didn't work. Like this was a disaster. You've got,
It's not all Mazzulla. That's for sure. No, it's not.
It's not. Their front court was as bad as any front court by the end of this, as any team in the playoffs. They got nothing from them.
Isn't it crazy how at the beginning of the season, the biggest question about the Celtics was the quality of their front court. Then over the course of the season, it became, oh yeah, Cade is really good. And they added Vooch. Even Garz is pretty solid. But then in the first round, the biggest problem with the Celtics was their front court. And that's what it's become. Yeah. But you are right, though, John, about the pressure aspect in Boston, because he won a finals. He did. And yet you still look at the last 4 years with Mazzulla, with him as head coach. And 4 years ago against the Miami Heat, an 8 seed, they trail 3-0 in the series, have to fight their way back to a game 7. They get destroyed in that game 7. The following year, they win the NBA Finals. But Jimmy Butler got hurt. Donovan Mitchell got hurt. Tyrese Halliburton got hurt on the way to the finals. An undeniably easier path to get there. And even Luka was hampered a bit in the finals himself. And I know the Celtics with Porzingis and others had some injuries as well. But that year they win it, but an easier path. Then last year against the Knicks, they're up 20 points in game 1, up 20 points in game 2. They blow both of those leads. They're up 14 points in game 4. They blow that lead. And then this year they have a 3-1 lead over the Sixers and they lose it over a 7 seed. And so since Tatum's rookie year, and Brown's second year, so this is going back to when Stevens was the coach, they've made the playoffs all 9 years. That's unbelievably impressive, of course. They've got 2 round 1 losses, 2 semifinal losses, 3 East Finals losses, 1 Finals loss in the Warriors year, and 1 championship the year they beat the Mavericks. It has been sustained success. However, some of the issues we saw in that game on Saturday, the stagnant offense coming back, it felt like the Celtics of a couple years ago. That has been a running theme since before the title, after the title. That title might be a one-off. Like, there's a chance, like, you can blame Mazzulla for the goofy starting lineup. You can blame Stevens for the Simons for Vooch trade. But there also might just be something fundamentally wrong deeper than that involving Brown's skill set, missing some passes in that game, slowing things down, but also the Mazzulla system. It is so reliant on three-pointers. They're down 1 in the game in the fourth quarter, and they're just jacking up 3 after 3 after 3. It felt like the 0 for 27 Rockets with no offensive variety. And that's where I look most, and I'm like, regardless of what happens with the roster, they need to address that aspect. How do you add more layers to this offensive system, more diversity in the sets we run?
I think that that's something that has to be looked at. And this is where maybe not that I'm trying to belabor the point, but he can adapt. Like,
yes,
this is where he's got to. Like, great coaches, when they feel like that things are getting read by opposing defenses and they become predictable, the great coaches have gone back to the lab and they've said, I'm cooking this up. I'm changing who I am. I'm studying things. And Joe's a junkie. Joe's a hoops junkie. The guy's at games religiously. You don't think that he's not going to try to say, all right, like I got to look. The stubborn ones, Kevin, are the ones who find themselves out of a job. Like, ultimately, Jamal Mosley gets relieved of his duties in Orlando just, you know, moments before we started recording, because Jamal Mosley had an offensive system that was bad. That was just flat out bad and seems tough.
That's a nice way to put it. It was bad.
I mean, it was bad. There's worse terms to use, but we'll keep it at that. You got to go back to the lab, and you've got to say, how do I change this? Brad, we got to fix our front court. Now, they don't have draft capital to do that. You know, what they have got to look in the mirror and say, here's what we do in the offseason to improve upon things. You know, do I think that they're dead? No, they're not dead, but they've got to find a way to find some avenues to improve their team.
If I worked for the Celtics front office, I would hate Jaylen Brown streaming on Twitch. I would hate it. It would piss me off to no ends. And especially the one he did on Sunday night, less than 24 hours after the loss. He calls out Embiid as a flopper during the stream. He defends the mistake he made towards the end of the game where Cato was seemingly open for a layup, and he did find Pritchard open in the corner for a three, but that speaks to the underlying issues with the system. He had an open guy at the rim. He defended that choice, saying, "I'd do it 100 times out of 100. He said, and I thought this was he blamed the refs, saying that the refs said there's an agenda against him. And I thought the worst one of all was he said his favorite year of basketball ever in his career. It wasn't the year the Celtics won 64 games. He got Eastern Conference Finals MVP and NBA Finals MVP and got a ring. It wasn't that year. Jaylen Brown said his favorite year of his basketball career was this year, the year they blew a 3-1 lead in the first round, the year his co-star Jason Tatum missed 67 games, including a game seven. I think it's absurd to say something like that.
Yeah, it's immature. It's bad. And that's a meeting. That's a calling. And,
it's ego.
You know,
it's ego is what it's it is. It's everything people say about him, that he wants to be the guy and he thinks he's the guy.
Great. Okay. So then guess what? You could be elsewhere and you could be the guy for a 5 seed or a 4 seed. Because I believe that to be true. I don't think he's the guy on a 1 or 2 seed. And if he was
the guy on a 2 seed this year, that's what he would say. I was the guy on a 2 seed. That's what he would say.
Yeah. How did it end? It ended with you on Twitch.
Yeah. Oh, God. I mean, you're not wrong, John. It's 100% true. Ended with you on Twitch 24 hours after the game.
and it's just like, Kevin, I don't love when we police things. Like, I'm going to say this. I'm not a big fan of when, like, media, and they're out there. Like, they go on X and they're going to start policing people of how they should behave.
Oh, but yeah.
You're a professional athlete and you're you're paid a lot of money. And we are looking at there's people out there who say that there's an ego and there's that. You don't go on a public platform and say that it's the most rewarding year of your career when it was a first round exit and you have a title ring. Listen to yourself. Come on.
It's ridiculous. It is. And look, I think it was Sam Amick a couple of weeks ago, maybe a month ago or so, said, you know, Giannis, Celtic stuff, and, you know, just something to think about. Because if I'm the Celtics, I'm looking at my situation and I'm like, do we just have something fundamentally wrong with the system? Have we reached the peak with Tatum and Brown? Was the peak the title year? Was that the peak? Does Brown actually want to be the guy elsewhere? I'd call the Bucks about Giannis. I would make the call if I'm Brad Stevens this morning. Start those conversations if you haven't done so already. And I would angle for something like this. Here's a fake trade for you, John. Celtics get Giannis. Hawks get Jaylen Brown. If Jaylen Brown ever were to leave, Atlanta is home. That's perhaps where he'd want to go and be one of the guys there. Imagine if the Hawks replaced Jonathan Kuminga with Jaylen Brown. Bucks get Kuminga, Reese Hoshea, Kispert, and lots of picks from both Boston and Atlanta. Like, to me, I look at this and I'm like, huh, this could make some sense. Giannis and Tatum can coexist there. Giannis plays some five. Maybe re-sign KP, Kristaps Porzingis for cheap this summer. He can be your floor spacing five. And then for the Bucks, get a ton of picks for Giannis, and the Hawks get an upgrade in Brown. Something like this, I feel like, is interesting. For all these teams, would you be making the call for Giannis if you're the Celtics, or is that just an obvious yes? Yeah, you're shaking your head.
I think there's teams still playing in the playoffs that are on the phones behind the scenes to make sure that they're in the mix.
I would be willing to put money on that.
You know, I believe that one of the teams that won a game seven this weekend that advanced onto the next round is still considering what their next wave of moves or what their next move is going to be. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. The fact is, like, I think there's going to be a number of teams, and I think specifically in the Eastern Conference, there's a couple, and Boston's definitely one of them. And the trade that you just proposed makes a lot of sense. For Milwaukee, they could do a lot worse. Like, Milwaukee would be getting talent there. They'd be getting some upside, and they'd be getting picks. I mean, there's a lot. If you're the Bucks and you think about the offer that you've put together with Kuminga, Risacher, and Kispert with a boatload of picks, you would have to strongly consider that, because they're in a position now where, you know, they don't need to blink. Milwaukee's in a, that's why it didn't make sense to trade him at the deadline, trade Giannis at the deadline. But Milwaukee's they have to nail this. They have to nail this.
You know, one thing I'll say quickly on the Bucks, a lot of time to discuss in the offseason ahead. Depending on what the draft rules become, there might be logic to either taking back a player like Jaylen Brown. There might be logic to looking for a boatload of picks because, you know, you can have a pick in the late lottery and have a chance to move up to number one. We're going to see how those rules look, and I think that'll give some clarity to what makes most sense for the Bucks moving forward. Speaking of the Hawks, I don't want to overlook the fact they lost, or at one point they trailed by 61 last week. They were trailing by 61 points in a game. It's just hard to believe. The Hawks this year, they have the 7th best lottery odds. So it was a good year overall, even though they trailed by 61 in their game that ended their season. So with the Hawks, they have the 6th best odds to move up to number one in the draft lottery because they have the rights to the Bucks pick, which is in the 10th spot there on the graphic. Atlanta is in a position right now where they could get number one, could move into the top four. Do you think, is there a best match for Atlanta? Like, who's the prospect that increases Atlanta's odds of competing most next year?
Well, you know, when I looked at this, it's interesting because I think that with their defensive versatility, with how that they can guard people, it would stand a benefit for them to get, you know, a live wire guard who can score in a lot of ways. And I would be fascinated to see. I think that there's a couple of variables here, but if they, let's just say they land at 7, everybody's debating, well, you know, Kingston Fleming's there, or if it's, you know, Brayden Burries gets brought up here and there, Keaton Wagler is the other name. But I think if you're Atlanta, I take a swing for Mykael Brown if I'm there. Because to me, Brown presents perhaps the most upside in at that point in the draft. And I think that we didn't even see his best, you know, this past year at Louisville. I think that he's got an ability to just score at a very high rate, quality positional size. He's got to prove himself in the workout settings in the lead up to the draft, but the shooting ability's there, and there's playmaking upside as well. But I like the positional size and what he can bring to the table. If things worked out for them and they got a, you know, let's just say they get a top 3 or 4 pick and whatnot, if the circumstances worked out, Darren Peterson in Atlanta would be unbelievable to watch in real time. You know, and they'd have to get lucky to get him. But yeah, it'd be unbelievable for them if the luck was on their side, Kevin, because I think when you pair Jalen Johnson, Nickeil Alexander-Walker, and a guard like that, that's a shot maker, provided he stays healthy. I know that's a big if, but like, it's the NBA now. I think DP is going to be just fine when he turns the page to the NBA. Like that would be, that for me is a pie in the sky Hollywood type for Atlanta, because I think Peterson can be a transcendent player. But if I'm Atlanta, I'm not saying you could do a lot worse than Keaton Wagler or Kingston Flemings. I like both those players. I think Flemings is a proper candidate. But if I was picking 7, if Mykael Brown is on the board, that's who I am taking in that position.
I mean, Mykael Brown, 45-point banger, then a ton of lows, right? Like, who is the real Mykael Brown is going to be the question for him in the draft, and proving himself next week at the NBA Draft Combine that he's over the back injury, I think it's going to be very big. And then proving he didn't quit either, I think that's going to be part of it as well. So I think for the Hawks, I like the Peterson fit. Can I learn behind McCollum? I really like that one. I think Caleb Wilson would be very interesting, add some athleticism to their front court. He can defend the perimeter next to Okongwu, can play as a big, or a two big system as well. I think there's really a lot of interesting fits for the Hawks in the draft, depending on where they land. The Pistons, they also had a 3-1 comeback. Tobias Harris, the series of his life. He shot the three like crap earlier in the series, but he was creating, getting to mid-range, hitting clutch shots down the stretch of games, and then he has the best game of his playoff life, really of his life, period. 30 points in a game seven, making clutch baskets throughout the game, helping extend that lead for the Pistons. And Cade Cunningham, I mean, look, he had the three-game stretch, games two, three, and four, with 24 turnovers, the most turnovers any player has had over a three-game stretch of the playoffs in NBA history. And then he turned it on after that. He became more efficient, found the mid-range. He started to find his three as well. The Magic, Mosley, for whatever reason, stopped sending early doubles at him. I don't understand that, but Cade Cunningham stepped up. Ausar Thompson, what looked like Draymond Green at times on defense. Detroit just stomped on the throat of the Magic, man. Like the ice, it's unbelievable they actually won this series, John. Down 24 points in game six. And then the Magic blew it. They blew it. They really just blew it. But the Pistons took it too. They took it. They took it. They ramped up their pressure in game six and carried it over to home in game seven.
Jalen Duren showed up too in game seven. He had 15 and 15. You know, he played defense. It was one of his best defensive performances. I thought he was all over the place. Detroit's rotations on the defensive end of the floor in the third quarter of this game gave them the game. I thought they were in all the right places. I'm with you. Ausar Thompson, by the game, is increasing what I think of him and what we think of them. The guy, he gives them an edge that's going to be needed against the Cleveland Cavaliers, because if they have that edge of toughness and physicality, no reason why they can't win the series. And that's a mammoth question mark for Cleveland still. It's still very much there. But Cade, this is a step for Cade. You're down 3-1. I don't care that it was against the 8 seed, right? I really don't. You know, you think about it, how wild has the Eastern Conference been? 13 times in the entirety of NBA playoffs history has a team come back from 3-1 down, and we watched it twice in 24 hours. So it just goes to show you how crazy this postseason's been. But for Detroit, the question's simple. Is Tobias Harris going to be the proper sidekick to Cade or not? And in Game 7, he was great. Cade is a scorer. You want to keep him as that. You don't want him to be an elite facilitator. The moment that he was beginning to find passing lanes and not turn the ball over is the moment that Orlando was stuck in this series and the moment that most teams would be. You want to keep Cade as one thing, not two.
I think that's a good way to put it. One thing, not two. And I think we'll probably see in the series a bit more doubling as well, something the Magic got away from. We'll be right back. I can't believe they lost that game. I mean, the Magic were like in giggling and laughing with each other, up 20 plus points against the Pistons in game six. And I think in a way they lost this series once Franz Wagner got hurt. Cause if you think back to game three, they blew a 17 point lead in the fourth quarter. Until Franz Wagner said, no, 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 no. We're not losing this game. And he took over down the stretch of that game. On the defensive end of the floor, Wagner was Orlando's best defender against Cade Cunningham. He's one of the reasons why they didn't feel like they had a throw two at him outside the perimeter. Then they lose him. They lose their steadying force on offense. They lose their best defender for Cade Cunningham. And because you don't have Franz, that means the ball is finding other guys more often. It means Paolo Banchero is isoing over and over and over and over and over again. That's not just, you know, Paolo's fault. It's Mosley's fault for having no imagination on the offensive end of the floor. It's his fault for not being able to unlock Desmond Bane. But a lot of the times the ball would find Jalen Suggs, who missed 36 of his last 44 shots in the series. He missed 36 of his last 44 shots in the series, John. I just... Oh my, if I were a Magic fan, I don't know how I could ever watch him again on my team. 4 for 28 from three, 4 for 16 from 2-point range. I would need him traded. He can't play for my team anymore if I'm a Magic fan.
It was dreadful. I mean, and he got open looks. I mean, that was the thing with Orlando. Like, I thought Detroit defended well, but you're going to get open shots. Do your complimentary guys hit them or not? And Suggs was. But the thing is, Kevin, like, Suggs is not supposed to be a complimentary guy. Like, there was a time where at least I thought he was going to be a really, really, really important piece to this team. He's not meeting the mark. You know, you're not supposed to be one of. You were drafted to be, it, provided you stay healthy, somebody who could be the guy at times. And it's just not, it's not happening. And I felt bad for Paolo. I really did. I listened to his post-game press conference, and he handled himself maturely. But you could just tell he knows it's not working. They went and got Desmond Bane. Desmond Bane, in this game seven, he wasn't there enough. And Orlando was a one-trick pony. And those are the teams that lose in the playoffs. Those are the teams that get solved and lose in the playoffs. And so for the Magic, they've got to make it. They're making a change. We all pretty much saw it coming. I would have been fascinated to see what they would have done had they won this series. And if that would have given Mosley maybe another year, or if not, they just had made their minds up already, which definitely feels like they did. We all thought that going into the play-in. We were surprised to see them here to begin with. We thought it'd be Charlotte. But they have reassessing to do. It's very, they are a square peg round hole team right now. And it's a combination of coaching, but their personnel. I will say this. I think teams in the NBA do this a lot. They say a coaching change will solve a lot. Kevin, we have subject matter that says coaching changes can solve things. But if things don't match in the shot-making department, no coach can start to put the ball into the hoop for certain players. Jalen Suggs is one of those players.
Yes, there's nothing Mosley could have done in that situation. The Pistons are funneling the ball to Jalen Suggs, and Jalen Suggs just did not come through. He did not make them pay for their defensive choices to leave him open in so many of those instances. You can't blame Mosley there. I think he lacked imagination with Desmond Bane all season long. The fact Desmond Bane was second on the team behind, guess who, Jalen Suggs and three-pointers per game on the full season is a joke. It's an utter joke. I interviewed Bane before the season. Bane came on my podcast, and we talked about, oh my God, two-man action between you and Paolo Banchero, two-man game between you and Wendell Carter. It didn't happen. It wasn't a thing. I asked him about, oh, like, your three-point rate has wavered each season in your career. I'd imagine this year you're going to hit a career high in threes. And he's like, yeah, I think so with this offense, the way we're playing and warm-ups and practices and all that. Well, it didn't happen. It didn't happen. He took five per game. They gave up five picks for a guy to take 5 3-pointers per game. And that's in part on Mosley, I think. So I think for the Magic, there is, you do want to look in the mirror and say, hey, Franz hasn't stayed healthy. Does Banchero have too many flaws? Should we move one of those guys? But at the same time, I'd be very interested to see those two with a new coach before I trade either Paolo or Franz, because their value isn't at its peak right now.
I agree with that.
I don't think it's great timing. And for the Magic, like you said, they were lucky in a way to be there, to get to a game seven, to even make it out of the play-in. Nobody thought they would. We thought they would be dead after the Celtics blew them out with career highs for Luka Garza, Ron Harper Jr., and Baylor Shireman. Kind of a coincidence there with the way Boston's season ended. Detroit moves on. When I texted you, 2 weeks ago to come on the podcast, I said to you, hey, you want to come on May 4th and talk about Pistons, Cavs, and other stuff in the playoffs? And you said, yeah, sure. So we put it in the calendar. And there's a moment last week. It looks like it might be Magic Raptors.
I texted you, I can't wait to talk Magic Raptors.
And it turned out we get what we thought we were going to get with Pistons versus Cavaliers. Cavs had a hard time versus Toronto going to a game seven. The Pistons are a bigger, better version of the Raptors in some ways. What's your number one concern for Cleveland entering the series?
James Harden and Donovan Mitchell living up to expectations or just not. Yeah. And the Cavs won the series over Toronto with them really not in game seven. I mean, Jared Allen changed the game. he did what we thought the Cavs would be able to do in four or five games against Toronto, where going into the series, Kevin, I remember thinking to myself, Evan Mobley should feast on this team. Jared Allen could feast on this team, but it's really Mobley who's the most I labeled Mobley as the most important player of the series because I thought Jakob Poeltl and company would succumb to him. Mobley was, well, he was underwhelming in all reality in the seven-game series. Jared Allen said enough is enough and had 22 and 19. And Kenny Atkinson literally said he was back in the tunnel as fierce as Kenny has ever seen him. And remember, Kenny was with him in Brooklyn. So they've been together, you know, for over half a decade, games, count hundreds of games together. Kenny said it was the most fired up he had ever seen Jared Allen. I will give James Harden and Donovan Mitchell credit for this. They played within themselves in game seven. They didn't do stuff to lose the game. I thought Mitchell was very good in the fourth quarter at facilitating and playing smart. I'm going to give him a lot of credit for playing smart and winning the series. If the Cavs had not won on Sunday night against Toronto, Dan Gilbert will have already made one change, if not multiple changes, in the works in Cleveland. He's not patient. He wants to win. He does not want to be in Tank City. But he would blow something up if he saw the writing on the wall. And the writing was going to be on the wall if the Cavs had lost this game. If Harden and Mitchell play in the level they're capable of, the Cavaliers are going to win this series. The thing is, I have doubts about whether that happens or not. The Cavs are deeper in the scoring column. Like Max Strus, Sam Merrill, even Jalen Tyson's giving the Cavs supporting cast has been good. Their supporting guys have been good. It's just Mitchell's been lost right now. And as a scorer, as a shooter, as a guy making his threes, you know, he shot 2 of 9 from three in this game. It's just Donovan. I'm waiting for the Donovan signature performance. And I think for Cleveland to take one of the first two games in Detroit, they're going to need that.
Is Mitchell hurt? Because like sometimes I'm watching him, I'm like, he doesn't feel as bursty, like as explosive off the dribble as he normally does. You know, do you see that too? Not just missed shots, but the process of him playing on the court too.
They feel slow at times. He feels a little bit slower than normal. I thought he looked better in game seven, and he was good at getting to the rim. But I don't know if you remember this. In game six, he had a drive and he had the lane for a layup, and he like threw up this floater that was way off late in the game. I remember thinking like, oh my God, like that's just not him. So you could be onto something there. But I think here's the thing. Cleveland, they've been waiting for this. You know, they strategically played for this matchup. They've won seven of the last 10 meetings over Detroit. And you fired J.B. Bickerstaff because you didn't believe he could get you to the Eastern Conference Finals. You made other changes as well, but you fired him because you didn't think you could get far with him. You hired Kenny. Now, Kenny had a bit of an up-and-down series. I'm going to give him credit. In Game 7, his demeanor was great for a team in a Game 7. He didn't get too fired up. He let his team play. And the composure factor was necessary. Now, if you're the Cavaliers, you better win this series, Kevin. You better. You made changes. And Detroit's got the guy that you previously had. So the pressure's on Kenny Atkinson. The pressure's on the Cleveland Cavaliers. And the pressure's on Donovan Mitchell. Donovan Mitchell has never had a better opportunity to break his conference finals drought. He has never been to a conference finals. Your stars got to perform. It can't, like, supporting Cavs have to step up. The Cavs are going to win at least, I believe they're going to win at least two games in this series. I think this series goes at least six games. But does Cleveland win it? They win it if their star wins the star matchup. And if Harden avoids turnovers, Harden's turnovers at times this series were terrible. James played okay. Like, I thought there were some good things from Harden. And the amount of defensive attention that Harden takes on is very important for the Cavs and their operation. But number 45, if he is healthy enough, which clearly he's healthy enough to be out there, he's got a ball.
I think you're spot on with everything you said about the Cavs side of things there. And I think it's the ultimate test for Harden or Mitchell going against Ausar Thompson, but it's also the ultimate test for Evan Mobley and Jared Allen. Can they handle the physicality of Jalen Duren and Beef Stew, even Paul Reed out there? They need basically game seven Jared Allen every night, 22, 19, and 5 stocks in the game. A career night for Jared Allen. Best game of his entire career with the intensity he brought in that game. They need that version against Jalen Duren to neutralize him. But also, I think that the Magic earlier in the series, part of the reason why life was so hard on Jalen Duren is because Cade wasn't hitting his pull-up threes. Cade adjusted, started hitting more pull-up mid-range jumpers. Eventually, his three started falling as well. I think that helped open the paint a little bit more for other guys on the team, Dern included. So I mentioned earlier, Franz Wagner did a very good job on Cade early in the series. What does Dean Wade do? He's got a similar body type to Franz Wagner. How is he against Cade Cunningham? And I know for a lot of people who aren't Cavs fans, they're like, who's Dean Wade? Dean Wade's good defensive player. He's a good player, John.
Yeah, you give up some offense because Strus can supply some things, but they'll go and they'll take Wade out for 3 or 4 minute doses, and they bring in Strus and Merrill together, and it's like DX is getting in the game for Cleveland. Like when those two come off the bench and they come strolling in, because it's like they always seem to come in together. But Dean Wade is the Cavs' best defensive player next to Mobley. Right now, Dean Wade actually might take the cake because I don't know what Mobley's doing at times defensively. He got into foul trouble in game 7. Like there's moments where I'm just like, that's a huge variable here, Kevin, is you've been relying on Evan Mobley to take the next step. Now they've advanced, so he's got more playoff sample size, but like he's not 22 anymore. He's not 21 anymore. He's 24 years of age. He's supposed to be going this way. And when I'm watching him right now, I'm like it's just teetering. And it's got to be consistent.
A plateau for Mobley.
But it's a big plateau. Wade, you're right. I mean, if the Cavs win this series, Dean Wade's presence on the defensive end of the floor will be one of the biggest 3 or 4 reasons why, because he can make Cade frustrated. He really can. And Cleveland, I'll say this. Darko Rajakovic coached his behind off in the first round series. And you could argue that Toronto's more measured without Ingram, but they still need Brandon Ingram to do some things. But like Scotty Barnes was great, man. He really was. Colin Murray-Boyles was a menace on both ends of the floor. So I don't disagree with you on like Detroit to step up, but I also think Toronto was playing damn good ball. They really were playing good basketball, and the Cavs had to earn it.
I think so too. I mean, Toronto stepped up big time. Even earlier in the series, they had no offense. They found some things throughout the series as well. And I mean, dude, what a rookie class. We talked about VJ Edgecombe earlier in the podcast, and then Colin Murray-Boyles. I think for the Raptors, you know, what did they learn here? They learned like they're in a great spot. They're missing a kind of a point guard to organize their offense, like a Bennett Sturts, somebody like that in the draft, a LeBaron Filon, like somebody like that I'd love to see surrounded by all their length and versatility. But they got a steal last year in Colin Murray-Boyles. They got something in him. And then Scotty Barnes, welcome. You have achieved stardom. Like that's what this series was for Scotty Barnes. He became a star with everything he did on defense, flying around, defending every inch of the floor. And then on offense, the dude hit clutch bucket after clutch bucket, made big plays as a playmaker as well. He was too big or too quick, depending on the guy he was being defended by. He was incredible. The Raptors found out they got a real foundation here, and now it's about finding the right supporting pieces that guard, but also a better center as well, because they just didn't have enough size to handle Jared Allen. If anything, Cleveland, as you said, should have finished it off earlier with their size advantage. But finding a big, finding a guard, they get everything else in between.
Well, 100%. And, you know, there were Raptors fans who were like, we're better without Quickly. But Quickly still gave Toronto pace. And the Cavs looked slow-footed at times. They did miss Quickly. I would have been interested to see what he would have provided in the series. But Toronto's got a bright future. They got a really good coach. I love the LeBaron Filon call. I mean, I think wherever Filon lands on draft night, he's going to be one of my gem pickups. Because, you know, he's not getting mentioned in the same column as a Acuff, Fleming's Wagler type, but he is he's going to be a good value pick. I fully believe it. That guy can just score. And Toronto, that's the thing with Toronto. They need perimeter shot making. They need people who can go and get theirs. That's what they need. They've got a lot of other pieces and parts. They're well on their way. They have an elite home court advantage. Like, Kevin, I underestimated this pick in the series. Raptors home playoff games are different, man. Those people are into it, and they make it loud. And the Cavs should have won one of the games in Toronto. They choked two games away out there, and they did. That crowd makes a diff. I actually think this is a hot take for the series in Detroit. And Pistons fans, I think you're great. This new building doesn't feel the same as the Palace. I'm interested to see Detroit fans in this series. Like, you got to bring it. Don't make the Cavs comfortable. You're the one seed. You just took a series from Orlando. I thought their crowd was great on Sunday, but like that Cleveland crowd Sunday night, they made a difference in the game. That crowd was intoxicated and wild. You Detroit fans, this is your time. Like, you're in the conference. Pistons, you're in the conference semifinals for the first time since 2008. This is a time to get riled up and will your team. And that's why the name of the game is, you know, which offense is going to be easier to read in this upcoming series between the Cavs and the Pistons. The offense that has more options is going to win.
You talking about Pistons fans reminds me of something Tom Brady said like 15, 16 years ago or something like that, where he's like, start drinking early, get rowdy, get lubed up.
Do it, man. Your team's in the semifinals, conference semifinals for the first time in 18 years. That place should be unconsciously loud.
It's so funny. I mean, you're right. They should. They definitely should be doing that. One thing you said, John, I just want, like, last thing I want to hit with you. The draft, because you said Filon could be a steal, right? I've had kind of split opinions on small guards as I've been watching the postseason, because on one hand, you see like a Reed Shepherd really struggle for Houston. Like, he's just too small. He can't offer any resistance on defense. He's good off ball, but couldn't offer any resistance and wasn't even as effective as a shooter. And then on the other hand, you see Maxey's speed and the difference that makes in a series. And you see the difference certain small players can still have on the game, whether it's a Jalen Brunson type or whether it's a Tyrese Maxey type or a Jamal Shedd type. But Jamal Shedd is an undrafted free agent. You know what I mean? And like Jalen Brunson was a second round pick. Tyrese Maxey went 21st in the draft. And when you're investing, and Reed was the third pick. And so there's a lot of small guards ranked in the lottery this year. There's guys like Darius Acuff, who's probably 6'1" and a half.
I know.
LeBaron Filon, who's 180-ish pounds and 6'3", 6'2", something like that. Mykal Brown's listed at 6'5". I can't wait to see what he measures at next week. I don't think he's actually 6'5", probably more like 6'3". You know, there's a lot of guards that are smaller. And so I've just had split thoughts. Even the Tyler Tanner types out of Vanderbilt. Tyler Tanner, one of the draft analytics darlings this year. Some people on the draft community online have him in their top five. But he's 6 feet flat, but he's an elite athlete. He's a high flyer as a 6 foot guy. I've got split opinions on that. It's tough. All I know is like drafting a small guard is an immense risk. And I think the postseason has really put that on display when it comes to taking them in the lottery.
Yeah, it's a huge thing. You know, it's why I think that during combine week, you're going to see guys with positional size and traits that say a coaching staff can develop them. I think you're going to see certain guys rise, certain guys help themselves. I think one of those guys is Chris Sinak, the Houston product. I've seen him getting mocked all over the place, and I think that somebody like that is going to pick up some traction here this week. I think next week. I think another guy that was a forward at Santa Clara, Jalen Williams home, Alan Graves,
the forward out of Santa Clara,
is a guy that I think does a lot of different things to help a team win. And that's just Dick Kevin. Like, do you want a numbers accumulator? Do you want a guy that impacts winning in a certain role? This draft class is deep. This is a great draft. Within the depth, this is why sometimes I know any GM would say, well, I'd rather pick seven. But I think sometimes it's you're less susceptible to getting the negative feedback when you're picking 16th or 17th and you miss than when you're picking seventh or eighth. But sometimes it's harder to pick seven or eight because you got more to pick from. But what are you really looking for? You know, a guy like Hannes Steinbach out of Washington is a guy that I'm fascinated to see throughout Combine Week and the lead up, because I think he presents a lot of different things as a matchup problem. These guys who are smaller, you just said it, NBA teams are showing they can pick them up in different ways that are not top six or seven draft pick. But there are multiple dudes here who went for 40, 45, 50 points in college games this past year that are getting mocked extremely high. And it's why there's a cutoff after Caleb Wilson in this class to which guard do you really love? Acuff's defense is a very real question. But like, I brought him up for the Hawks because I think the Hawks do need scoring. And I think that they can hide him. But do you want to pick a guy that you could hide defensively? Or do you want to pick a guy that you think could be a really, really strong number three or four option on your team? Those are the fundamental questions you have to think about.
I mean, we'll see how the draft lottery goes on Sunday. How the board falls is going to determine a lot of this. But for right now, it feels like the consensus is those top four, like you said, AJ, Peterson, Boozer, Wilson in some order. And then after that, it's Keaton Wagler, Acuff, Michael Brown, you know, it's a lot of these Braden Burries. It's a lot of these guards. It's not going to shock me if come draft night, you see Kareem Lopez, Yaxel Lendenborg, Adai Mara, some of these names, even a Hannes Steinbeck move ahead of some of those guards. It wouldn't shock me one bit if that's the direction this goes, because even a Nate Amint out of Tennessee is up and down as his year was. 6'10" guys who can handle the ball and stroke threes don't grow on trees. And small guards do. A lot of teams have guards. A lot of teams have guards across the NBA, including teams in the lottery. So it's going to depend on how the board falls. Like if Memphis needs a guard to replace Ja Morant, if they move up to number one, that's suddenly a team that needs a guard that's probably not taking a guard because they'll be in the top four unless it's Peterson. Dallas might need a guard to have learned behind Kyrie Irving for the future next to Cooper Flagg. If they move into the top four, it could be a Peterson team, but maybe they're a Cam Boozer team. And that means another team that doesn't need a guard could be sliding down, like Utah. Utah has Keontae George already. Would they really want to take Darius Acuff? I don't know about that. Sunday's going to determine everything. But bottom line, though, John, I think some of those forwards I mentioned, Yaxel, Kareem Lopez, and so on, and the bigs, Mara, could move ahead of these guards. I wouldn't be shocked by that one bit.
Sleeper, and I'm sure we'll do, we always record sometime ahead of the draft. I always love doing this with you, but real sleeper going into Combine Week that'll keep picking up traction, I believe, is Dalen Swain out of Texas. I think you're going to continue to see his name come up in circles because of the different positional size and versatility that he provides. Those two words are so, those two ideas are so big in the draft, and that's why I'm with you. Yaxel Lendenborg led a team to a national championship and has all of the attributes that say he can play in an NBA game. No, I would not be surprised if he hops a one-and-done freshman who still has a high level of unknown.
No, not at all. And Swain's a great call, John, because 6'8", very talented isolation scorer, very talented defensive playmaker, always in the passing lanes with his long wingspan. He's going to measure well athletically. His physical profile is going to be an A+. It's just about how does he shoot? Like, does his three-point jumper look better? We'll see there. And I think, you know, one other similar name, testing the waters, we'll see if he actually stays in the draft. Billy Richmond out of Arkansas, high flyer, downhill attacker, gritty defensive player, really good connective passer as well. He's like Josh Hart-esque for that Arkansas team. He just can't shoot. If he suddenly, you know, after the college season has been working on that three, it continues getting better, he might be a guy where it's like a team says, we'll take you in the top 20. We'll take you in the top 25. And hey, maybe he's not going to go back next year because I think he's got a chance to really show out Combine Week. Guys like that, like we're kind of thinking along the same lines. You had Swain on your mind. I had Richmond on our mind, where those guys could be real risers throughout the draft process because, you know, small guards can get picked on. And we'll see how it goes moving forward for the ones remaining in the NBA playoffs. John, we definitely going to do this again with a full draft podcast before the NBA draft in late June. Woo! What a playoff, man. The Wild East, as you said, the Wild East. What a fun time it's been.
I love it in every way, Kevin. I always love joining your show. And we've only just begun on that road to gym. Let's go.
Yes, we have. It's just the first round. Second round to come starting on Monday night. Later on today, I'm going to have Adam Ares talking about the Western Conference side of things and some other big picture topics around the league. John, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks, KLC. Great to be with you.
You might have heard me say it earlier, but a quick heads up. We are changing the schedule during the remainder of the playoffs to three times a week, every Monday, Tuesday, and Thursday. We're going to be posting podcasts Monday, Tuesdays, and Thursdays for the rest of the NBA playoffs and the pre-draft phase. I'm stoked about it. We're going to have a lot more shows, hopefully some shorter shows as well. That's kind of the plan there. But today, we do have a two-parter start of the semifinals, looking back at what we learned in the first round as well. Today was with John Fanta. Big thank you to him. Later today, we got part two with Adam Mares from DNVR and the All-NBA show. Him and I planned this a couple weeks back. I did not know Denver would lose the series. But hey, we'll be talking about the future of the Nuggets as well, in addition to previewing the Western Conference semifinals. So hang on for that later today. Thank you to Emmy and the team for producing today's episode. Talk to you later.